What price authentic freedom? It is incalculable. It is everything. As with all prophets of class, Prince foresaw its end, but it doesn't take much vision to see this, as we're all born with our inherent freedom. It just requires paying attention. But there are some among us, and power knows this and looks for them, who have authentic visions of that which must be, because in some sense, they've already happened. Quote, even I do not know when the visions began. Certainly I was not more than 7 years old. But I remember the first coming very distinctly. My brother Joel and I had made a hen take an egg back and been caught as we turned the hen loose. We knew we were in for it and decided to scatter until things cooled down a bit. He hid out in the barn, but I combined discretion with pleasure and ran clear off the place. Mr. Lindsay's house was vacant for a spell. He was a neighbor who was off working somewhere at the time. I'd not thought of stopping there when I set out, but I saw a big raisin lying on the porch and stopped to eat it. There was some cool shade on the porch, so I sat down, and soon I was asleep in a strange way. Like clear-cut stereo opticon slides, I saw 12 scenes flash before me, each one held until I had seen it well in every detail, and then be replaced by another. There was no continuity, as in an average dream, just disconnected scene after scene with blank spaces in between. I knew that they were all true, a preview of things to come, and my soul writhed in agony and shrunk away. But I knew there was no shrinking. These things had to be. I didn't wake up when the last one flickered and vanished. I merely sat up and saw the Methodist church, the line of moss-drained oaks, and our strawberry patch stretching off to the left. So when I left the porch, I left a great deal behind me. I was weighed down with a power I did not want. I had knowledge before its time. I knew my fate. I knew that I would be an orphan and homeless. I knew that while I was still helpless, that the comforting circle of my family would be broken, and that I would have to wander cold and friendless until I'd served my time. I would stand beside a dark pool of water and see a huge fish move slowly away at a time when I would be somehow in the depth of despair. I would hurry to catch a train with doubts and fears driving me and seek solace in a place and fail to find it when I arrived. Then cross many tracks to board the train again. I knew that a house, a shotgun-built house that needed a new coat of white paint, held torture for me, but I must go. I saw deep love betrayed, but I must feel and know it. There was no turning back. And last of all, I would come to a big house. Two women waited there for me. I could not see their faces, but I knew one to be young and one to be old. One of them was arranging some queer-shaped flowers, such as I had never seen. When I had come to these women, then I would be at the end of my pilgrimage, but not the end of my life. Then I would know peace and love and what goes with those things, and not before. These visions would return at irregular intervals, sometimes two or three nights running, sometimes weeks and months apart. I had no warning. I went to bed and they came. The details were always the same, except in the last picture. Once or twice I saw the old faceless woman standing outdoors beside a tall plant with that same off-shaped white flower. She turned suddenly from it to welcome me. I knew what was going on in the house without going in. It was all so familiar to me. I never told anyone around me about these strange things. It was too different. They would laugh me off as a storyteller. Besides, I had a feeling of difference from my fellow men, and I didn't want it to be found out. Oh, how I cried out to be just as everybody else. But the voice said, no, I must go where I was sent. The weight of the commandment laid heavy and made me moody at times. When I was an ordinary child, with no knowledge of things but the life around me, I was reasonably happy. I would hope that the call would never come again. But even as I hoped, I knew that the cup meant for my lips would not pass. I must drink the bitter drink. I studied people all around me, searching for someone to fend it off. But I was told inside myself that there was no one. It gave me a feeling of terrible aloneness. I stood in a world of vanished communion with my kind, which is worse than if it had never been. Nothing is so desolate as a place where life has been and gone. I stood on a soundless island in a tideless sea. Time was to prove the truth of my visions, for one by one they came to pass. As soon as one was fulfilled, it ceased to come. As this happened, I counted them off one by one and took consolation in the fact that one more station was passed, thus bringing me nearer the end of my trials and nearer to the big house with the kind women and the strange white flowers. Years later, after the last one had come and gone, I read a sentence or a paragraph now and then in the columns of O.O. McIntyre, which perhaps held no special meaning for the millions who read him, but in which I could see through those slight revelations that he had had similar experiences. Kipling knew the feeling for himself, for he wrote of it very definitely in his Plain Tales from the Hills. So I took comfort in knowing that there were fellow pilgrims on my strange road. I consider that my real childhood ended with the coming of the pronouncements. True, I played, fought, and studied with other children, but always I stood apart within. Often I was in some lonesome wilderness, suffering strange things and agonies, while other children in the same yard played without a care. I asked myself, why me? Why? Why? A cosmic loneliness was my shadow. Nothing and nobody around me really touched me. It's one of the blessings of this world that few people see visions and dream dreams. And that's unquote from Zora Neale Hurston's Dust Tracks on a Road.